The expressed views of the guests on this podcast are theirs alone and not necessarily endorsed by the host, TWBC, or any associated sponsor. Conversations that are robust yet balanced, on point and to the point. You are listening to The Talk of Tournament Water Ski. This is the TWBC podcast. And now, here's your host, Tony Lightfoot.
Well, greetings one and all, and welcome to this edition of the TWBC podcast. My name is Tony Lightfoot, and so glad to have your support once again. So, whenever we look at the drivers across the world, probably some of the legendary drivers comes to mind, Jack Walker and the likes of Al Rucker and loads of other drivers have graced tournaments across the world, but one of the ones that has stood out in recent times is the man that's sitting next to me and one of the drivers for the Swiss Pro Slalom for 2025. It is none other than Scott Greenwood. So how you doing, sir?
Doing great, Tony. Glad to be here.
All right then. So as the wind picks up a little bit here, the conditions start to get a little bit interesting here at the site for the Swiss Pro Slalom, and we're recording this the day before. So we want to try and find out a little bit more about Scott Greenwood. You know, how he got to this point. You know, how you got to this point of being one of the elite drivers in the world. But I mean, let's start from the very beginning, like how you got into this sport and what has happened from that point to where we are right now.
Well, Tony, we did one of these a few years back, if you remember, at Lake 38, and I'll try to keep the version a little different, but
of course,
I grew up skiing on Lake Hamilton in Hot Springs, Arkansas, with my siblings, my father and mother, and my four siblings, and it just became kind of a fun, and it was always some competition between brothers and sisters and who could get up the youngest and who could get up on a slalom ski. And at one point there was my father, my mother, and everybody in the family could slalom, and that was a big deal when you skied on a public lake. And it was, at that time, it was kind of cool, right, for the family to all be out there skiing and having a good time.
Indeed. And what was your introduction into like semi-serious tournament skiing like? I mean, because you kind of described that idyllic situation where you have you and your family, you know, you're out there tubing, you're out there getting up on one and doing the hot dogging type stuff. But when you were introduced to a ramp and a slalom course, what was that situation? I mean, how I bet you were kind of taken aback a little bit.
Well, just kind of going back, it was, I just remember my older brother I always looked up to, and one of our other family friends, a guy named Russell Rainey, my brother Greg, they were kind of the hot dogs on the lake, and the big thing back then was to clear two wakes, jump one wake and clear all the way past the second wake, and they were kind of the
or give us the highest spray.
Whatever, in the spray, and so we were doing whatever we could do to be competitive in those days. And then Russell Rainey got my brother involved in just some novice water ski tournaments on open water. They're all the tournaments in back in those days in the late 70s were on a public lake. And so my brother and Russell had skied in a couple of these novice tournaments, and they brought me to one in 1979, and I skied my first tournament. And I kind of told that story years ago.
Uh-huh.
So it was just amazing. I loved it and had a great time. Had a lot of success at my first tournament, and just want to continue to find ways to get back to a slalom course somewhere.
Indeed. And that wasn't too far away from you actually going to college and going to Louisiana Monroe, or as it was called back then, NLU, Northeast Louisiana University. And of it, so you competed there, and you also found your wife there, didn't you? Yes.
And
How did that happen?
I have to give a big happy birthday to my wife. Today is her birthday, and I'm down here in Florida. So we've been talking throughout the day, and it'll be 32 years this summer on the June the 26th. And I'm still as in love or even more in love now than I've ever been.
Oh, that is just absolutely sweet.
So water skiing has given me the greatest thing in my life is my wife and my family. So that's exciting. But kind of going back to skiing, it was literally, we were trying to build slalom courses on the lake with jugs, like you hear these stories, and that was us.
Just like the gallon milk jugs.
That gallon milk jug.
Just put a little bit of spray paint on them.
We didn't even spray paint them. We had no idea what we were doing. We barely had measurements, and we would just stick buoys out and Clorox bottles, and we kind of tried to simulate what people are doing. And then for the next several years through high school, I was looking to build relationships with people that would take me to the lake. And I built a relationship with a guy named Greg Steinbeck. He was a 32-year-old architect, was running an architecture firm in Little Rock, and somehow I got connected with him, and I would literally ride my 10-speed to his house downtown if I couldn't get a ride, or he'd come pick me up in high school, and we would go in his 1960, it was like a Chris Craft boat, and we would go to the local ski club, and he was a member, and I would pay him per ride, and I would pull him, he'd pull me, and we were kind of learning how to jump and learn how to trick ski along with the slalom skiing. And
so basically really, really grassroots stuff, you know. You didn't go anywhere to be coached or do anything like that and bring those skills back. You were just, you know, trial and error back in those
it
days
was.
A little bit,
you know. There was a community of water skiing. It was different back then. There wasn't the man-made ski lakes, but there was a couple of guys that are my age, Wade Cox and Cal Tate, and a guy named Bobby Gibson. And these were the guys in my age that were in a situation or at a local club and had the support of, you know, their families that were training. They were skiing, and I was still kind of hammering it out on the public water and looking for buoys. And that kind of continued on. I kind of continued in the novice scene. You know, mom and dad, there was five kids. They couldn't stop everything they were doing because we were playing baseball, basketball, and football. And my sisters were doing, you know, dance. And so we were spread really thin. And so I couldn't pull them away to just start water skiing like we do today. All these families are putting a lot of time into this water ski.
Yeah, because back in those days, I mean, you could do it all. I mean,
you did, yeah.
You did, and you could do it all. Yeah. Now it not so much, you know. And I think that's probably what skiing is kind of missing a little bit, that kind of fun, you know, aspect to it. You know, where people go out there and just have a have a blast, have a good time. You know, it's this. I mean, in this generation, you know, I know a lot of the kids that I see, a lot of the competitors are all steely focused and everything like that.
Yeah.
And it takes a while for them to actually get past that and to a situation where they're working, and then water skiing's more fun again, you know, and they're more relaxed and they tend to perform better a little bit, in my estimation.
Yeah, yeah. And kind of going back, you know, as you're saying, you could do a lot of things because there was in baseball. Now there's summer ball, fall ball, spring ball, winter ball, training.
Ball.
Right now my son is at a basketball tournament, so he's doing the summer basketball. He's already finished his winter basketball for high school, so he's
having... This is Chewy, of course.
This is Chewy, Matthew Greenwood. And so he's, you know, it's a lot to juggle, but every sport has a fall soccer and football. There's so much year-round training now, where when I was a kid, you did your season and you moved to a different season. And so within that, I was able to fit water skiing in with my family.
Yeah, imagine pro football players having to play two seasons, you know, like NFL and USL or what have you. I mean, you're just going to do it. Your body's going to take an absolute beating doing that.
So skiing's really evolved. And as I, you know, went through this, you know, stayed kind of more in a novice circuit, I kind of snuck myself on. I went to school in Monroe. I was skiing some tournaments. I was getting a little better in the local club. And I went to Monroe. I'd hurt myself my senior year. I'd already gotten to the point where I'd skied some regionals, but I wasn't a standout skier. And I went to Monroe because they had the construction management program. And I always had in the back of my mind, I wanted to figure out how to get on that ski team.
So I'm starting to make the link between what you actually do as a profession and what you did in college.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. So dad had a, you know, construction business. He grew, you know, his first 20 years, he was in the building material business. He's managed a big building material supplier in Little Rock. And so we kind of grew up in that field, and he left and started a commercial, or went in with a commercial business with a friend, and then eventually moved on to his own in the residential construction. So after I got out of school, I moved, you know, that was a good transition for me. But anyhow, you know, going through college, I got to Monroe, and I just made some friends. And my sophomore year, my freshman year, I was just talking to Jeremy and Jason. I pledged a fraternity, Kappa Sig, my first year, and those guys did after I left. So most every skier that went through the school in Monroe that did pledge a fraternity, it was always Kappa Sig, which is kind of cool. We were sharing some stories.
Another one of those connections. Yeah. That you...
So I was just telling them, you know, after I kind of, Dean Murphy gave me an opportunity to be a B-team skier my sophomore year.
Oh, okay.
So we won't count years of how long I was in college, but I skied as a B-teamer. My entire sophomore year, and then I came back and started skiing. I had access to a ski course every day.
Wow.
And I'm skiing with guys like Zach Morgan, Fritz
Harsh.
This
is on the Bayou Desert.
And Shay Langley, Brian Swenson. Shay, Brian, and a guy named Fritz Harsh, we skied every day together. Shay was a major influence on me skiing, mainly in tricking and slalom. Had a great time skiing. He was the funnest guy I think I've ever skied with over the years. He was an amazing skier. And just being around great skiers made me realize, and watching them every day. And then I was driving the boat at that point.
Was that your first real experience of you actually driving for like elite competition level skiers? Because I mean, back in those days, the skiers that you mentioned, Zach Morgan, Shay Langley, they were among the best of the best at competing in the national championships.
They were, you know, very high level. And yeah. That was the first time I had been, pulling skiers at that level. I remember my first time. I was at the Arkadelphia Ski Club on Lake De Grey, and I was skiing with Wade Cox and Kyle Tate, and we were 15, 14 years old, and they said, "You drive." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I'm going to do this course." And we were just all happy to be there. Those guys were upper level already as we were younger, and they were probably laughing at me.
I bet Wade Cox was a beast to pull, wasn't he?
Well, he was just a little skinny kid at the time, you know.
No, because we always think of Wade Cox as being this powerhouse that was dominating the Pro Tour in late 80s, early 90s, on the cusp of the 2Ks.
Yeah, he was just, at that time, Wade was a very scrawny young man from Prescott, Arkansas, a real small town, but he could ski. He was amazing. He was you've probably heard stories, but he was a high-level tricker and jumper. He was on the cups of breaking the that 142 Sammy Duvall jump record, if you remember back. That was a national record that lasted forever and ever and ever, and Wade... was right on the cusp when he hurt himself, and then that was kind of the beginning of the end for him in three-event skiing. That was the beginning, being there on Arkadelphia, in Arkadelphia there at the Arleigh Moore little ski lake, the little ski club there, and that was the first time in the boat. And then, of course, back at the ski club, you start driving, but then when you get to Monroe, like you said, Tony, we were in the boat with the best skiers in the world at the time. You know, Zach Morgan and Fritz Harsh were the top two skiers in the country at that time. And then you just, I think for me, it was, I was kind of the rookie. And so I was real attentive to everything.
Indeed.
From getting a chance to pull the pin to watching skiers anytime I could get a chance, and then getting in the boat. And I think that's kind of where maybe I excelled, because I was really paying attention. I was really attentive to what was going on. And
now, pulling the pin back in those days was literal.
Oh, it was literal. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was Shay Langley was one of the top toe trickers in the world at the time. And I ended up being his pin guy because I was attentive. I always joke with my friends. I was talking to Brian Swenson a few weeks ago, and I said, "You guys are always joking around," and they were all good. I wasn't very good. I was trying to learn all these tricks, and they would all ski, and then I would get out there do my, you know, trying to learn reverse toe back or toe-o, the simpler tricks, and they're just not even paying attention to me. And it was real, and it really.
Oh, did he fall? Okay.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so I thought every time I'm in the boat, I'm going to be more attentive because I knew how it felt to be just, you know, the low guy. But I think that was somewhere in that I was able to excel, but just because I was just being way more attentive to what the task was.
Absorbent like a sponge, you know, yeah. just trying to bring everything in and just try and learn from it. But yeah, I mean, that sowed the seeds for you driving. I mean, back in those days, it was hand-driven.
It was hand-driven.
So you had to have a little bit of a feel for the rhythm of the skiers and what have you, which contrasting today, I mean, you've got speed control, you've got shore path, you got all of that stuff, but you still have to have that kind of sense and that kind of rhythm for driving. We're going to see if we can try and link those two somewhere in the middle, because I mean, once you got out of college, you continued to ski and excel at national championship level. So kind of pick us up from there.
Well, look, one of the guys that probably pushed me the most as a driver. There was a young guy that came to school in Monroe when I was there. There's a guy named John Riker. Do you remember John?
Can't say that I do, but regale me.
He was kind of the top level skier at the time. Zach had moved on, graduated, had some hip problems, and kind of got out of skiing. And Harsh had moved on, and he was there, and I become. You know, it was, he came to me every day to pull him, and he was very intense. And think about the low horsepower of the boats, and you've been on the bayou with the levee on that end in the short setup, and we're running air gauge speedometers and hand driving.
So basically it would hit 36 just as it got into the course.
Yeah, but the air gauge doesn't even make it doesn't register because it's nice and slow, right? You'll be at 36 and the air gauge is still working its way to 36. So you're
driving on the revs.
So you're deciding, do I drive on the sound or the tack? And so a lot of times, so you're driving, you're hand driving, you're looking at the course, and you're either having to take peeks at the tack or you have to listen to the engine. So it got to a point where you just kind of listened to the engine. And then once you got on the course, you could watch that half mile an hour swing down and up and down and up is how we drove in those days. Mm-hmm. And so moving forward to your question is, when cruise control came, there was a lot of heartburn and agitation from the old timers because it was such a craft and such an art to drive by hand and by sound. But what I saw was that, one, for me as a skier, it enhanced my ability to ski and have a much more consistent pull.
Mm-hmm.
And then what it took was all these things that you're doing. You're having to do some visuals that you don't do today, and you have to make hand movements, and it's walking and chewing bubble gum and then adding one more. It's juggling three things, right? So now I was real receptive to it because it took, now we're looking at, okay, we're just steering. We're just steering the boat. We're not handling the speed. You know, we're not having to look at a gauge. So we're driving. So what it did, it really calmed down all the juggles that you had in the boat, and it made things much easier for the driver.
But it seems to have packaged all of those focuses that you had back in the day with the tack and what have you and the speed, and it shifted all of that towards a singular focus and just being able to, like, kind of like have a dance with the skier the lighter skiers like Camille Bamra,
yeah,
I mean, probably doesn't have an awful lot of work attached to him, and then compare him to someone like an Aaron Davies, mm-hmm. or who would be one of the more vicious skiers that you have to work against.
One that we all enjoy watching and a lot of highlights are Caldwell.
Caldwell.
Yeah, he's fun to watch. There's a lot of skiers that have a lot of power.
Robert Pagosi.
There you go. Mm-hmm. And you'd be amazed that they look a lot more powerful, but they understand their speed, and they're not as heavy as they look. They're not as heavy on the boat as they look. But anyway, so narrowing down a little bit, Tony, now we have more of a singular focus.
Yeah.
And it's this focus becomes steering, and it becomes rhythm, like you were talking about, and just kind of understanding how the boat, every boat has a different, we sometimes call it a chemical reaction. Every boat likes to move differently when the pressure's on to the, you know, in slalom, for instance, to, from turn to center line. So you get more intimate with the rhythm of the boat and how to prepare the boat for the pull and how to allow the skier to move up to the top of the turn. So it just allows you to have more of a singular focus instead of being so overwhelmed with all the other things that are going on back in the day of hand driving.
Indeed. And the level in which you drive right now, I mean, you're a sought after driver. I mean, you're going to go to Morocco. You've already driven the world championships of two seasons back. You do a number of tournaments, you know, whether it be collegiate, international, national level competition. So, I mean, how did you get to be this good to where people, organizers saying, I want Scott Greenwood to be here?
You got to look back to mentorships. You know, I think I really enjoy I'm a bit ADD, so I really enjoy all the factors when I'm driving, going through the course, feeling everything and being in this matrix through the course when things are getting crazy. But I go back to, you know, mentors. You said Al Rucker.
Yeah, God rest his soul.
Yeah, and sitting in the back of the Suburban with Al Rucker, Jay Bennett, and Ralph Armstrong, driving to dinner after a long day at a Bennett's tournament and listening to just their theory and philosophies and engines and how they're pulling these skiers, it really interests me. But I got to really appreciate a good friend of mine that gave me an opportunity. Jay gave me my first opportunity to drive a jump tournament. But the one person that gave me the biggest opportunity, and I knew I was ready to drive at this level, was my good friend Chad Scott. And last time we talked, I didn't get a chance to say say that. Chad and I have been friends for a long time, and he and I have shared concept and theory and strategy for a long time, and he's taught me more about slalom skiing than I think anybody's ever taught me.
All right, so as we try and wrap up this podcast, actually, you are such an in-demand driver that someone's already wanting you to drive right there. Jaime Palomino, he's about to practice. But we'll end off with a couple of questions, the first of which, if you had to offer any kind of advice to an aspiring driver in this modern day and age where you had like zero off and shore path and all of the technical wizardry that's there, knowing what you know, lay it on them.
Rhythm trumps everything. Rhythm trumps these numbers that we get into this minutia. Learn how to understand what the skiers need and how to facilitate them to get through the course. All they want to do is go fast. They need to go fast. They need to be ignited. They need ignition.
You sound like Ricky Bobby.
There you go. Yeah. I don't know what to do with my hands. No, they just understand what it means to what a jumper needs, understand what a slalom skier needs, and learn to facilitate that. Turn the sure path off, keep it simple, stay focused, and listen for the skier. Listen for the rhythm and learn how to ski in rhythm and communicate. Find somebody in your group that you can really talk to about what it feels like so you can get input.
Indeed. And we'll end it right there. Any parting words for your fans, family, whomever else?
Happy birthday, Janie Bug.
All right, then. And with that concludes this episode of the TWBC podcast. Thank you very much for joining me here, Scott. And thanks a lot to you, guys and girls out there for tuning in. But until next time, this is Tony Lightfoot saying ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to the TWBC podcast. Be sure to check out our website at waterskibroadcasting.com. Links to our presence on major social media platforms can be found there, as well as updates to our webcast and this podcast. Duplication or rebroadcasting of this broadcast without written consent of TWBC is prohibited. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to join us next time for the next edition of the TWBC Podcast.